Lawyers battle over testimony of Frank's nervousness. Witness swears Negro was in factory about 1 o'clock. The Atlanta Journal, Friday, 1st August, 1913, page 1, column 1. Jurymen sketched as they listened to evidence in Frank case. Illustration credit, bottom right. Brenton courtroom, reading from left to right. Lower row, A.H. Hensley, M.S. Woodward, Debtor Townsend, F.V.L. Smith, A.L. Wilby, M. Johenning. Back row, J.F. Higdon, Fred E. Winburn, W.S. Medcalf, Charles J. Burchart, J.T. Osborne, W.M. Jeffries. Darley's admissions about Frank's demeanor, offset by his evidence in rebuttal. Having admitted Frank trembled, that he was pale and seemed upset, on cross-examination, Mr. Darley said Frank was naturally of a nervous temperament and told of tedious work he did on Saturday in preparing financial sheet. Judge Roan reverses his ruling in reference to evidence about whether others were nervous. Attorneys for defense had intimated that his refusal to admit this evidence was good ground for appeal. Mrs. White's testimony that she saw Negro lurking. Near stairway at 1 o'clock Saturday, a feature of morning session. Little progress was made at the morning session, Friday of the fifth day of the trial of Leo M. Frank, for the murder of Mary Fagan. The state showed by one witness that a Negro was sitting on a box on the main floor shortly before 1 o'clock at the point Jim Conley claims he was sitting when he says Frank called him. The state also introduced its best testimony relative to the nervousness and general demeanor of the defendant on the morning that the crime was discovered. The witness who gave this testimony was N. V. Darley, who also materially aided the defense by a number of points brought out on his cross-examination by attorney Reuben R. Arnold. Considered of special value to the defense was his statement that with the time clock in the condition that it was on Sunday, anyone understanding its mechanism could have made the punches for 12 hours within 5 minutes. The defense brought out by Darley a statement that it had been hammering home since the trial first started, namely that the elevator and its motor made much noise when running, and that a saw on the fourth floor ran simultaneously with the elevator. The inference is that the defense will argue that if the elevator ran shortly after noon or even up to 3 o'clock, that White and Denham, working on the fourth floor, would necessarily have heard it. The same witness also asserted that a financial sheet gotten up Saturday afternoon was in Frank's handwriting and that it takes 3 hours or more to do this work. The defense made a timely rebuttal of Darley's testimony that Frank displayed unusual nervousness following the discovery of the murder, and used Darley himself to refute, to a certain extent, his own testimony. Solicitor Dorsey, in his examination of the witness, had drawn the statement from him that the accused was nervous, that his hand trembled when he went to run the elevator, and that he was pale and was trembling when he rode to the police station. When attorney Arnold took the witness, he drew from him the assertion that Mr. Frank was of a natural nervous temperament and that frequently he, Darley, had to take charge of affairs at the factory prior to the murder on account of the accused's nervousness. Frank, declared Darley, often rubbed his hands together and was unable to do much work when he was in one of his nervous states. Mrs. White was also an important witness in reference to Frank's nervousness, declaring that when she went into the factory at about 12:30, just after the state claims the crime was committed, Frank jumped when she spoke to him. When court convened after lunch, Judge Roan reversed himself on his ruling at the morning session. By reversing this ruling, he holds now that the defense may introduce evidence to show that others besides the accused were nervous at the pencil factory following the discovery of the body of Mary Fagan. Attorney Rosser, for the defense, had indicated in a remark to the court at the morning session that the defense would likely appeal the case on this point if the jurist held to his ruling. Judge Roan also announced his decision in the matter of Darley testifying relative to the contrast or comparison of handwriting on the financial sheet made out by Frank on the Saturday of the murder and others made out prior to that date. Judge Roan held that Darley would have to qualify as a handwriting expert to testify along these lines. State introduces witnesses. Mr. Arnold, in a discussion with attorneys for the state, made the remark that the prosecution need not fear that he would fail to introduce any evidence at all, as the attorneys now think it will. It will probably introduce many witnesses, and the trial will be prolonged a number of days. At the close of the morning session Friday, the indications were that the state would not close its case until Tuesday or Wednesday of next week. Jim Conley, the state's principal witness, has not been called yet, and probably will not be until Saturday. It will take a whole day, if not longer, for his examination. Court convenes. At 8:40 o'clock, the crowd was admitted to the courtroom, filling the seats immediately and leaving a number of disappointed people outside. A large part of the crowd had been waiting since 7 o'clock. Leo M. Frank, the accused, arrived early under custody of the sheriff. He entered the courtroom at 8:50 o'clock with his wife and mother, smiling cheerfully and responding to the greetings of a number of friends. Mrs. J. Arthur White was called to the stand as the first witness. Her husband has been employed by the National Pencil Company for the past 2 years, she said. On April 26th, she testified, she went to the National Pencil Factory twice. The first time she remained from 11:30 to 11:50 o'clock. She returned at 12:30 and left about 1. On the first visit, she stated she saw Miss Hall, the stenographer, and two men in his office. I asked Mr. Frank if I could see Mr. White. Mr. Frank then was standing in the inside office. He asked me if I was Mr. White's wife, and when I answered yes, he said I looked like a Campbell. The witness explained that her father and brother, named Campbell, had been working for 2 years in the National Pencil Factory. Mr. Frank sent Miss Emma Freeman for Mr. White, and he came down and talked to me at the foot of the steps on the second floor. Solicitor Dorsey questioned the witness about her second visit to the factory. Mrs. White said that she looked at the clock when she arrived on her second visit, and that the time was about 12:30, possibly 1 minute to or after that hour. Says Frank jumped. When I came up the steps, she said, I saw Mr. Frank standing by the safe in the outside office. His back was turned to me. I asked him if Mr. White and Mr. Denham had gone back to work. He jumped, as if surprised. Is there any doubt about his jumping? Asked the solicitor. No. What was he doing at the safe? I didn't see him doing anything. What did you do? I went upstairs to the fourth floor where Harry Denham and my husband were working. They were working on continued on page 5, corner 1. Page 5, column 1, lawyer's battle over testimony of Frank's nervousness. Continued from page 1, a machine with a hammer. I heard the hammer distinctly when I reached the fourth floor. They quit work when I came up. How many times did you have to ask Mr. Frank if White and Denham were at work? I had to repeat my question. The witness testified that while she was upstairs, about 1 o'clock, Frank came up and told her that she would have to leave then if she expected to get out before 3 o'clock, because he was going out and intended to lock the doors behind him. What time did you leave? Sometime about 1 o'clock. Was it before or after 1? It was before 1. How do you know it was before 1? Because I was in McDonald's furniture store at 1 o'clock. And how far is that from the pencil factory? 5 or 6 blocks. How much before 1 do you say it was? About 10 minutes. Mrs. White said that Frank preceded her down the stairs. She left the building. Saw a Negro also. When she went by the office on her way out, Frank was sitting by a table in the outer office with his coat off. What was he doing at the table? I suppose he was writing. What led you to believe he was writing? Well, he was sitting there. As you came down the steps from the second floor, did you see anybody? Yes, a Negro. Where was he? Sitting on a box to the bottom of the stairway leading from the second floor. Did you see his coat? No. Did you see his hat? No. Solicitor Dorsey walked up to the witness stand with Mary Fagan's parasol and, handing it to Mrs. White, asked her to point out the spot on the diagram where the Negro was sitting. She pointed to a place in the lower hallway, near the stairway. The solicitor also asked her to point out the place on the fourth floor, where Denham and White were working. She put the end of the pointer on a place several feet toward the front of the building from the top of the stairway on the fourth floor. Could they see down the stairway from where they were working? No, sir. Rosser takes witness. Mr. Rosser took up the cross-examination of the witness. You left the factory about 1 o'clock, Mrs. White? Yes. You are not sure as to the exact time? No, sir. How long after 1 o'clock was it that you reached the furniture store? I don't know exactly. You won't say positively that it was 10 minutes to 1 when they left the factory? No, sir, not positively. It was somewhere about 1 o'clock? Yes, sir. Where is that furniture store and how far from the factory? It is on Mitchell Street beyond the terminal station. Did you walk there directly from the factory? Yes, sir. Mr. Rosser stopped to refer to a statement which the witness furnished to the defense some time ago. You say it was about 1 o'clock when you left the factory, but you didn't look at the clock? Yes, sir. It was about 1. I did not look at the clock. You got to the factory the first time about 11:30 o'clock? Yes. And you say you found there two men whose names you didn't know, Mr. Frank and the stenographer, Miss Hall? Yes. You didn't see the office boy, Alonzo Mann? No. You went in and sat down in Frank's office? Yes. He was talking to two men? Yes. After he had finished talking to the two men, he came over to you, did he not? Yes. You told him you wanted to see Mr. White? Yes. Did you see your brother, Wade Campbell, or your father there? Frank sent word. No, sir. They both work there, do they not? Yes. Frank sent word up to White that you were downstairs and wanted to see him, did he not? Yes. By whom did he send this word? By Mrs. Emma Freeman. The witness said that Mrs. Emma Freeman formerly was Miss Emma Clark and had married just the day before. How long was it before White came down? About 5 minutes. Where was it you talked with him? Outside of the office, near the time clock. How long did you talk with him there? About 15 minutes. Who came up while you were talking to your husband? Cornelia Hall, Mrs. Freeman, and Mrs. May Barrett. The witness added that these three came down the stairs. Mrs. Barrett's daughter also came in, coming upstairs, she continued. Who left first? Miss Hall and Mrs. Freeman. Who next? Mrs. Barrett and her daughter. You left last? Yes, sir. What time was it when you left? About 10 minutes to 12 o'clock. You couldn't say accurately as to the time you left? No, sir. You went somewhere uptown, we don't care where did you not? Yes, sir. How long did you stay? About 40 minutes. And you came back to the factory about 12:30? Yes, sir, it was 12:30. How do you know? I looked at the clock that time. Where did you say Frank was when you came back? He was standing in front of the safe in the outer office. What was Frank doing? What was he doing? Did he look like he was taking something out of the safe or putting something into the safe? He didn't appear to be doing anything. Was the safe door open? Yes. When the safe door is open, it closes up against the inside office door, does it not? Yes. When you spoke to Frank, where were you? He photoed blood spots. Photo by Wynn R. P. Barrett, machinist who found blood spots on floor of metal room, hair on lathe, and part of a pay envelope near machine where Mary Fagan worked. I was inside the office door and just behind Mr. Frank. And he appeared startled? Yes, sir. Acted as a person does when someone comes up on them unexpectedly? Yes, sir. That's what I thought. You asked Frank if White still was upstairs? Yes, sir. What did Frank say? He told me that he was, and suggested that I go on upstairs, which I did. After a while, Frank came up and asked your husband and Harry Denham if they had finished their work. I don't know, sir. I didn't hear him ask that. You heard him say to your husband if your wife wants to get out before 3 o'clock, she'd better go pretty soon? I'm not sure as to the exact words he used. What Frank said. Here, Mr. Rosser read from the statement which had been furnished to him by the witness. If your wife wants to get out before I go to lunch, read Mr. Rosser, she'd better get out in a few minutes, for I'm going as soon as I get my hat and coat. Mrs. White said that was about the language used by Frank. You remained a few minutes after Frank went down? Yes. And when you came down to the office floor, you saw Frank at a table in the outer office, writing? Yes. You then went on down the steps to the street floor? Yes. As you came down, just where did you see the Negro? Between the stairway and the door. Just what do you mean by between the stairway and the door? Between the front of the stairway and the door? Yes. How far from the front of the stairs? About 5 or 6 feet. Attorney Rosser asked the witness to point out, on a blueprint of the plant which he produced, the spot where she saw the Negro. He brought from the witness a statement that she had talked with Solicitor Dorsey about 2 weeks after the tragedy. Attorney Frank Hooper took up the redirect examination. The Negro was not sitting against the wall, was he? No. Darley testifies. The witness was excused. Solicitor Dorsey called Arthur White, who did not answer. He called Arthur Denham, who did not answer. Then he called N.V. Darley, who took the stand. Mr. Darley stated that he has charge of the employees at the National Pencil Factory. His immediate superior is Sig Montag. Darley is a coworker and rated equally with Frank. Mr. Darley stated that he was in the factory on Saturday, April 26th, that he left there about 9:40 a.m., and that he returned there the following day at 8:18 or 8:20 o'clock in the morning, and as he came in, Mr. Frank came up. "Did you observe anything unusual about Frank?" asked the solicitor. "Not at first, but when we got into the elevator and he reached for the rope, I noticed that his hands were trembling. His hands still were trembling when he started to nail up the door in the basement. I took the hammer from him because his hands were trembling and he was nervous, and also because I could handle the hammer better." The statement that he thought he could handle the hammer better was ruled out after some discussion. Darley said that he could not remember very well the conversations that morning. Asked specifically if he remembered Frank saying anything about coffee, he said, "Yes. As we were starting away from the factory, he said that he had been called from home without any breakfast or coffee, and that they had taken him straight down to the undertaker's into a dark room where they suddenly flashed on a light and he instantly saw the corpse and that he was nervous. He said that he wouldn't have been nervous if he'd had a chance to get some breakfast." The witness continued that he remembered that at 10 o'clock, Frank telephoned to his home about getting his breakfast ready. Darley was asked about the elevator. The key of the lock to the power box was in place, but the box was not locked that morning. He didn't know where the key was. He saw Newt Lee that morning, he said, in answer to a question, and Lee seemed to be composed. "What did Frank say with reference to the staple and the hasp?" asked the solicitor. Frank referred to the easy manner in which they could be pulled out and seemed to think that the crime was committed in the basement. The witness's statement that Frank seemed to think the crime was committed in the basement was ruled out. Darley said that the staple in the back door looked like it had been pulled out before. "It was black," he said, "and usually when a staple is pulled out the first time it looks rather red." "You said Frank intimated that the murder occurred in the basement. What were his words?" inquired the solicitor. "I don't remember. Frank talked of nervousness. The day after this talk about coffee, did you talk with Frank about coffee again or his condition on that day?" "Yes." "What did he say?" "About the same thing." "Did he say next day anything about being nervous?" "Yes." "How many times did you hear him explain or try to explain his nervousness?" Attorney Rosser objected. The solicitor reframed his question. "How many times did you hear him talk about the murder?" "Numerous times. I don't remember the exact number." Mr. Dorsey asked permission to read to the jury a statement that Darley previously had made to him. Attorney Rosser objected. The solicitor contented himself with showing the statement to Mr. Darley to refresh his memory. He asked Darley this question after the witness had scanned the paper. "Now, what was more on Frank's mind, the murder or the explanation of his nervousness?" Attorney Rosser jumped to his feet. "That won't do," he exclaimed. Judge Rowan sustained the objection. "I think I should be permitted to read this statement to the jury, Your Honor," said Mr. Dorsey, addressing the court. A heated colloquy between attorneys followed. Attorney Arnold, seated, said, "He hasn't made his usual showing, Your Honor, that he has been entrapped." "I don't hesitate to do it," replied Mr. Dorsey. "You don't hesitate to do anything," said Mr. Arnold. It appeared that Judge Roan ruled against reading the statement. "How much of his body shook?" the solicitor inquired. Darley answered that he couldn't remember. "Tell the truth about this statement," admonished the solicitor. Darley replied, "My words there are that he shook all over." "Is that true or not?" Mr. Rosser objected. "The solicitor had no right to cross-question his own witness," said Mr. Rosser. Judge Rowan sustained Mr. Rosser. "When and where was it that you first saw Frank shaking all over?" hand was trembling. When we were going down in the elevator, he reached up to pull the rope and his hand was trembling. I can't say positively about his body, though. Could Frank or not have driven the nails in the back door? I guess he could, but I thought I could do it better. The solicitor showed Mr. Darley his statement and asked, "What do you say now?" "Just the same," was the reply. "How did Frank look Sunday morning?" "Pale." "Can you or not say that he was upset?" Attorney Rosser objected. "The solicitor can't say upset, Your Honor." "Oh yes, I can," retorted the solicitor. "I guess the jury knows what upset means. I'll cite you some authorities on that." Solicitor Dorsey read several authorities tending to show that his questions were proper. One of these set out that it could be shown that a person was nervous, worried, excited, preoccupied, pale, and that it was proper to develop evidence as to his movements, appearance, behavior, and bearing. Judge Roan interrupted, declaring, "That doesn't touch the point we have up here now, Mr. Dorsey. The witness says that the defendant was nervous. He must show how and why he was nervous. Question is allowed." "Why does Your Honor select the word nervous?" inquired the solicitor. "Upset is a term which is well understood by the members of this jury, and I dare say by everyone in this courtroom." "Go ahead and ask him the question," directed the court. "Mr. Darley," commanded the solicitor, "just state to this jury whether or not Leo M. Frank appeared upset on that Monday morning, and if so, why and how." The witness replied that he wouldn't say as to that. "Now look here," shouted the solicitor, as he advanced toward the witness with the latter's written statement. Attorney Rosser, jumping to his feet, declared, "Your Honor, he can't do that. He can't snarl at this witness. He mustn't talk to this witness in that manner. This is his own witness, and he can't dispute him." "Your Honor," answered the solicitor, "I've got a right to show by this witness Frank's conduct and manner. I want to read you another decision to show you that I've got that right." The solicitor then read a decision which was to the effect that it could be shown whether a person accused had appeared wild, whether he had shown satisfaction or dissatisfaction, and several other specific terms of conduct. "Let him get the law," shouted Mr. Rosser. Before Solicitor Dorsey could send for the laws, Judge Roan, addressing the solicitor, said, "I don't need the laws. I understand perfectly what can be done. You can't wild and stop there without explaining how and why." Addressing the witness, Solicitor Dorsey asked, "Say whether or not on Sunday morning, April 27th, Leo M. Frank looked upset. If so, why? State the reasons to the jury." Darley answered that Frank did appear upset. Solicitor Dorsey submitted the witness's previous statement to him, and after he had read a paragraph, continued on page 6, Kerner 1. Page 6, column 1. Witness swears. Negro was in factory at about 1 o'clock. Continued from page 5. Indicated by the solicitor asked, "Have you answered those questions now as you did before?" "I object, Your Honor," said Mr. Rosser. "He can't ask the witness that question." Judge Roan sustained Mr. Rosser. "Frank, done up." The solicitor then put this question to the witness. "Do you state whether or not Leo M. Frank was or was not completely done up? Whichever way you state, give your reasons." "Wait a minute," spoke up Mr. Arnold. "Done up might mean that he was dead. It might mean anything else. We object to that." "I'll risk the jury on the meaning of that," said the solicitor. Attorney Rosser interrupted. "Your Honor," said he, "we'll decide on risking the jury, not my friend Dorsey." The court permitted the solicitor to ask the question. Darley replied, "He was partially done up. That's as far as I can state now." "Why do you say partially?" asked the solicitor. "Well, Mr. Frank was able to attend to some business around the factory, and if he had been completely done up, he couldn't have done that." "Did you take an automobile ride with Frank Sunday morning?" "Yes, I went in an automobile with him to the station house." "Where did you sit in the automobile?" "On the front seat beside Rogers, the driver." "Where did Frank sit?" "He sat on my left knee." "Well, what was his condition then?" "He was trembling and shaking." "Was Newt Lee in the automobile?" "Yes." "Well, was Newt Lee composed or nervous?" "Lee's testimony." "Valueless?" Attorney Rosser objected. The court previously had ruled out such a question. Judge Roan asked the solicitor if he insisted upon putting the question. Both Solicitor Dorsey and Attorney Hooper addressed the court, declaring the state's willingness for everything to go out of the record about Newtley. Attorney Rosser insisted that whatever was to be withdrawn from the record must be stated specifically. Judge Roan directed the solicitor to sit down and draw up what he wished withdrawn from the record. The solicitor declared it would be impossible. "It would be an interminable job," said he. Attorney Rosser sought to explain to the court what questions with reference to Lee had been ruled out previously, stating that they applied to the Negro's condition whether he was nervous or not. Solicitor Dorsey remarked that the state was perfectly willing for all references to Lee being nervous to be stricken from the record. "Your Honor," said Mr. Rosser, "it's not a favor that they are conferring upon me. But it has at last dawned upon Lee's testimony stands," Attorney Hooper replied, addressing the court. "I don't want it to go down in records, Your Honor, what my friend Rosser has just said in regard to it taking a long time for anything to dawn upon us. Mr. Rosser's statement was one of criticism, and I don't care for him to pass upon how long it takes anything to soak into my head." Mr. Hooper's remarks were in the nature of a rebuke to Mr. Rosser. Nothing was done, however, by the court, and the trial proceeded. Mr. Dorsey seemed oblivious of Mr. Rosser's criticism. Judge Roan ruled out all references to Newtley's demeanor during the trial of the case. This was done at the solicitor's instance by agreement of both sides. All questions which brought answers regarding Newtley's demeanor and all answers to that effect were ordered stricken from the records. The trial went on. "Did you see the financial sheet Monday morning?" "Yes. Frank picked it up and said something about it." "After Gant was discharged, did he come to the factory?" "Yes, once or twice." "Did you see Frank examine the financial sheet Sunday?" "I think so. I know I looked at it." "When did Mr. Haas, the agent for the insurance company, come down to the factory?"
"About May 1st.
"When was the factory cleaned up after that?"
"May 3rd.
The solicitor pointed to the spot on the diagram where the bloody stick is supposed to have been found and asked if that area was cleaned up. "Orders for a general cleaning had been given," answered the witness. "He didn't know anything about that particular area. Arnold de questions. Darley." Attorney Arnold took up the cross-examination, asking who called Darley's attention to the blood spots which Barrett claimed to have found. "Lemmy Quinn." The state objected to Attorney Arnold's use of the phrase "claimed to have been found." Judge Roan sustained the objection. Attorney Arnold asked the witness about the hair on the lathe. Darley said that it required such expert work that there hadn't been a financial sheet made out since Frank left the factory, although it was the custom to have them made every week. Darley continued that Frank usually started on the financial sheet about 2:30 o'clock on Saturday and finished it about 5:30 or later. When shown the sheet, he declared that it was all in Frank's handwriting. No work had been done on it when he left the factory at 9:40 o'clock. Mr. Arnold asked the witness how the handwriting by Frank on the financial sheet in evidence compared with Frank's handwriting on previous financial sheets. Wanted comparison. Solicitor Dorsey objected on the ground that the previous sheets themselves were the best possible evidence and that Darley was no handwriting expert and therefore was not competent. The solicitor read a section of the Georgia Code to support that view. There followed a 20-minute argument on this question, in which all four of the principal attorneys at various times took the floor. Attorney Hooper, in one of his arguments, said that the defense had no right to show the sheet to the jury without showing previous sheets, so that the jury itself could compare them.
"You need have no fear, Mr. Hooper," said Mr. Arnold. "They'll be introduced at the proper time."
At the conclusion of this questioning, Judge Roan withheld his decision until he could look up authorities in the matter. Attorney Arnold questioned the witness on the various items in the financial sheet and the calculations. Darley said that it was necessary in computing the sheet to go into each individual item on the sheet. At the conclusion of this questioning, the solicitor asked, "Are you through with him, Mr. Arnold?"
"Oh, no, no," replied Mr. Arnold. "We haven't got a good start with him yet."
"On Sunday, you were in the pencil factory, were you not?" continued Mr. Arnold, addressing the witness.
"Yes."
"Detective Starnes was there, wasn't he?"
"Yes."
"He went through the factory with you, didn't he?"
"Yes."
40 or 50 people were in that building on Sunday, were there not?"
"Not Sunday. My recollection is that there were 6 or 8 there.
Did you go down into the basement?
Yes.
There was a great deal of excitement, wasn't there?
Yes. You were excited, weren't you?
Everybody excited.
Yes.
Everybody was excited?
Solicitor Dorsey objected. Attorney Arnold argued the point. The defense had the right to show the state of mind of everybody else in the factory, in order to compare it with Frank's conduct. He spoke of Frank's having missed his breakfast and his coffee that morning, and remarked, "Everybody that drinks coffee knows that when an habitual user misses his usual drink, he is unnerved."
The policemen were excited, said he. "I think I have the right to show that Frank manifested merely natural excitement. This young man was superintendent of the factory, and a little girl had been murdered there. It was no more than natural to assume that he had been perturbed. The state seems to be basing its whole prosecution on whether or not Frank was excited on the morning the body was discovered. This is a question which never should have been admitted to the case." Attorney Rosser followed Mr. Arnold with argument upon the point. "Let me tell you what I saw once," said he. "We had a riot here some years ago. I saw 200 men and they were all excited. Now suppose they tried me for lunacy and told of my excitement, said that I made a fool of myself. Would you hold that I couldn't say that anybody else around me was excited?" Solicitor Dorsey argued the point from the state's standpoint. "They've gone on record that you couldn't take up the deportment of Lee and compare it with that of Frank," said he. "They objected to our doing that, and they got it into the records. I want to know how far this is going to continue. Are you going to open the floodgates and show the deportment of every man who went into the factory, when the only question at issue is the deportment of Frank?" Attorney Arnold asked Darley what was the condition of the other people around the factory that morning. Solicitor Dorsey immediately renewed, "Continued on page 7, column 1. Darley's admissions are offset. Continued from page 6. His objection." Attorney Rosser declared, "This jury won't know but that Frank was the sole man who was nervous that morning. The jury won't know that my friend Starnes, sleuth that he is, and that son of the Emerald Isle, Pat Campbell, were excited when they looked on that girl's body. Are you going to take this young man and show how it affected him and close the mouths of all these other witnesses?" Rosser's warning. "Your Honor, I want to impress on you that a misstep here would vitiate this whole trial." A moment later, Mr. Rosser repeated this statement, taken to mean conclusively that the defense is laying its foundations for an appeal. Solicitor Dorsey arose. "If there is any doubt in your honor's mind," said the solicitor, "about this matter, I have here a number of decisions. This question they are seeking to put is simply a dragnet proposition. They want to run them all in on it." The solicitor read 2 or 3 decisions to sustain his contention. "Wouldn't it be monstrous, your honor, to go outside of this trial and this evidence and run in everybody and anybody to show that they may or may not have been nervous? The one point to be made before this jury is as to whether or not the defendant was nervous. At the instance of the defense, the state already has agreed and your honor has ruled that a similar question applying to Newt Lee should be withdrawn from the record." "I adhere to my former ruling," said Judge Roan. Attorney Arnold arose. "I purpose to prove by this witness, your honor, that he himself was excited and nervous and that the others present were nervous and excited." "Perhaps that's a different question," said the judge. "I thought you wanted to go out and bring in others who were not present. If you want to show that he and others were excited from the some cause, that might be a different proposition." Judge Roan asked the solicitor if he renewed his objection. "I most certainly do, your honor," answered the solicitor. Judge Roan announced that he would hold to his former ruling. Resuming his cross-examination of the witness, Attorney Arnold asked, "Isn't it a fact that there are a good many spots on the metal room floor? And that you have seen spots there from time to time?" "Yes, I've seen spots all over the factory."
"Red spots and dark spots?"
"Yes."
"About red spots. How long have you worked in factories?"
"Yes."
"Isn't it a usual and frequent fact that blood spots are found around the women's dressing rooms and closets?"
"This is a well-known fact."
"Yes." "You see such spots at this factory?"
"Yes."
"You nailed up the back door. Why did you do that?"
"Because the staple had been pulled out."
You did so because you had had more experience in that line than Frank, did you not?
Yes, that was one reason. And Frank was nervous too.
Frank wore a brown suit on Saturday?
Yes.
And on Monday, he wore the same brown suit?
Yes.
Were you accustomed to see him on Sundays?
No.
Then you couldn't tell what kind of clothes he wore usually on Sundays?
No.
He wore a different one the Sunday you saw him at the factory?
Yes.
But you don't know about his Sunday clothes?
No.
Well, on Monday, did you observe any spots on the brown suit worn by Frank then and on Saturday?
No, sir.
Frank not scratched. Did you observe any scratches or bruises on his face or hands?
I didn't see any.
Saturday morning when you came to the factory, Frank was there, was he not?
Yes.
Whom else did you find there?
Maddie Smith, one of the employees, was in the office. She came for her own and her sister-in-law's pay. She found that her sister-in-law's time was wrong.
Frank told her to wait a little while and he would straighten it out, that he didn't want to get his cash out of balance. The girl gave me back the money when she found it was wrong. The mistake was made on account of the similarity of the two girls' names. Maddie Smith's sister-in-law was named Mamie Smith, and Mamie's pay had been put in Maddie's envelope. Frank corrected this mistake. Then the girl called my attention to the fact that we had promised to raise Mamie's pay, but hadn't done it. I told her we would straighten this out next week.
Why, Maddie Smith cried.
I asked her how her father was. She replied that he is dying, I think. I assisted her from the office down the stairs to the street door. She was crying. She asked me if the office would aid her in the matter of funeral expenses for her father. I sought to console and cheer her. I told her we would do whatever we could for her and advised her not to worry about her sister-in-law's time. Attorney Arnold inquired, "What time was it when Maddie Smith left the factory?"
"About 9:20 o'clock," the witness answered.
"Then you went back upstairs to the office?"
"Yes."
"What time was it Frank went to Montag Brothers?"
"About 9:40 o'clock. We went out together. We stopped at a soda fountain a short distance up the street and got a drink. Afterward, Frank went on to Montag's, and I didn't see him again until next morning."
"Was the elevator locked or unlocked on Sunday morning?"
"It was unlocked, but the lock was in place."
"Could anybody have started the elevator?"
"Yes."
"Does the same motor that drives the elevator drive the saw?"
"Yes."
"Do both the elevator and the saw run at the same time?"
"Yes,
unless the belt to the saw is thrown off."
"When the elevator is running, it makes a great deal of noise, does it not?"
"Elevator's noise."
"Yes, it makes a great deal of noise, but not as loud when it starts as when it stops at the bottom."
"About these cords, Mr. Darley, they can be found all over the factory, can't they? From the basement to the top?"
"Yes, sir."
"They frequently are swept up into the trash, are they not?"
"Yes, sir, I often make complaints about that."
"A great deal of waste is gathered up in the factory, is it not?"
"Yes, sir,
several truckloads every day."
"When was it you say the factory was cleaned up?"
"It was given a special cleaning on May 3rd, but it was given a general cleaning on the Tuesday after the murder."
"There are many crevices and corners that haven't been cleaned yet, aren't there?"
"Yes, sir."
"How long is the factory building?"
"Between 150 and 200 feet, I should say."
"And it's about 70 to 100 feet wide?"
"Yes, sir."
"The factory is an extremely dirty place, is it not?"
"Yes, sir."
"In some places, the gum and dirt is about an inch thick, is it not?"
"Yes, sir."
"And it's about 1/8 of an inch thick in some places on the metal room floor?"
"Yes."
"Isn't it dark on the first floor and in the basement?"
"It is very dark in the basement and quite dark on the first floor when the front doors are closed."
"Is it dark around the wall on the first floor near the radiator?"
"Yes, sir, especially so on cloudy days."
"What kind of a day was it on April 26th?
"It was very dark and misty all day."
"What was on the first floor on that day?"
"A dozen or more large empty boxes were piled there."
"There were plenty of places for a man to hide in those boxes, weren't there?"
"Yes, sir."
"There's not so much light on the second floor between the time clocks and the metal room doors, is there?"
"No, sir." Well, how is it in the little walkway off to the left from the metal room?
It is very dark.
From Frank's private office at the desk, you can't see the steps, can you?
No.
How far is it from his office to the metal room?
About 100 feet.
Can the doors to the metal room be locked?
No.
Behind this dressing room, what is there?
It's used as a storeroom for worthless stock, and also there are 3 or 4 vats in there.
In answer to questions, the witness said that a person practically could have the run of the factory without being seen from Frank's office. How did you happen to go to Solicitor Dorsey's office? Twice I was served with subpoenas, and once he phoned for me. Did you know that he had no right to subpoena you?
Not then.
Did you know that those subpoenas were not worth the paper they were written on?
I since have heard so.
The first time you went to his office, who was there?
Chief Lanford, Mr. Stevens, Mr. Dorsey, and the stenographer.
Did they all ask you questions?
All but the stenographer. One of them would ask a question sometimes before I could finish my answer to another's question.
Who was there the second time?
Mr. Dorsey, Detective Starnes and Campbell, and a stenographer. Then I was questioned only by Mr. Dorsey.
Is Frank a man of a nervous temperament?
Frank's nervous temperament.
Yes. Whenever the smallest thing went wrong at the factory, he would get very nervous and upset and would go about rubbing his hands. I've seen him do it 1,000 times.
The witness said that he considers his own nerves good, that he would take charge when Frank became nervous.
Darley was shown the notes found by Mary Fagan's body. Scratch paper like that on which one of the notes was written was to be found generally through the factory, said he, as many of the tablets were used.
Order blank paper like that on which the second note was written often was thrown on the floor and swept up in the rubbish, he said.
The witness said that despite orders, the time clock door was unlocked on Saturday, and that anyone who understood the clock could have made regular punches for a whole night within 5 minutes. Darley said that he had seen Wade Campbell, a man named Linus, and a man Irby at the factory on Saturday. At this point, at 12:20 o'clock, Judge Roan announced recess of the court until 2 o'clock. Roan reverses ruling. Immediately after convening court Friday afternoon, Judge L.S. Roan announced that during the noon recess, he had given due consideration to 2 points raised during the morning, on one of which he had ruled and on the other of which he had reserved his ruling. At the morning session, Solicitor Dorsey objected to a question put by the defense to Darley, saying that Darley could not testify as to whether or not the handwriting by Frank on the financial sheet produced in evidence was like that on previous financial sheets drawn by Frank, that the other sheets themselves were the best evidence. On that point, said Judge Roan, he ruled that Darley could not testify unless he qualified as a handwriting expert, that the defense would have to introduce the other writings and allow those writings to speak for themselves to the jury. On the second point, Judge Roan said, he reversed his ruling. That point was on an objection by the state that the defense should not be allowed to show the mental condition of others than Frank in the factory on Sunday morning, April 27th. Judge Roan ruled with the solicitor at the morning session. This was the ruling which he reversed, giving his decision instead to the contention of the defense. N.V. Darley, general manager at the National Pencil Factory, resumed the stand at the afternoon session, the defense resuming its cross-questioning of him.
At my request, did you look over the pencil factory during the noon hour?
Began Mr. Arnold.
Yes, sir.
Diagram inaccurate. I want you to state whether or not there are any inaccuracies in this drawing. If so, tell me what they are. Darley took Mary Fagan's parasol as a pointer and pointed to the stairway at the rear of the basement leading to the first floor and said,
These steps are too short. The incline is 17 feet. Apparently, this isn't the correct proportion.
What is the space between the wall of the elevator shaft and Frank's office?
It's 5 feet.
How wide is the elevator shaft?
About 10 feet.
Well, isn't the space on this diagram between the walls of the elevator shaft and Frank's office almost as wide as the elevator shaft itself?
Yes.
Then the drawing is out of proportion, is it?
Yes.
Anybody coming down the steps between the second and the third floor of the building has a full view of the time clock?
Yes, sir.
Anybody coming down these stairs could see anybody in the metal room, couldn't he?
Yes, sir.
Did you ever see Frank as nervous previously as on the morning of the murder? Frank, usually nervous.
Yes, sir. One day he saw a little girl run down by a streetcar and he was so nervous that he couldn't work on his books. Frank is of an extremely nervous temperament, isn't he? Hardly a day goes by that he does not become nervous. Was everybody nervous around the pencil factory Sunday morning?
Yes.
Were you nervous?
Yes. I didn't tremble, though.
Mr. Darley, I want to call your attention to another mistake in this picture. Isn't the bottom of the ladder leading from the first floor into the basement closer to the elevator than this diagram shows? The distance between the bottom of the ladder and the elevator shaft is 6 feet. Doesn't it appear to be more in this drawing? Doesn't it look as if it was as far as the width of the elevator shaft?
Almost as far.
Page 7, column 2. One of State's important witnesses, Mrs. Arthur White. She was on the stand Friday, testifying about her visits to the factory on the day crime was committed. Page 7, column 5. Frank trial, crowd sees, auto knockdown youth. Thronged streets prevented driver seeing Raymond Roddy, not seriously hurt Raymond Roddy, a 13-year-old boy who lives at 66 William Street, was knocked down by an automobile about 9 o'clock Thursday morning near the corner of Pryor and East Hunter Street, not far from the old courthouse where the Frank trial is taking place. The boy was crossing Pryor Street at the time, attracted by the crowd of curiosity seekers gathered around the courthouse. The automobile was driven by H.H. Hooten of the Adams Grocery Company, who was taking it to the shop on Mitchell Street. On account of the crowded street, it is said, Hooten did not see the boy until the machine was upon him. The accident is said by spectators to have been unavoidable. The little fellow was not unconscious, and at the Grady Hospital, where he was taken, physicians said that he would probably be able to leave during the morning. No bones were broken. Page 1, column 3. Picnic and Theories, Mark Noon. Hour in Frank Trial Courtroom. Spectators remain from 5 to 7 lunch boys acquiring wealth. A courtroom where a man is on trial for his life is a strange place for a picnic. Yet from 12:30 to 2 o'clock every afternoon, the room where the Frank trial is taking place has all the appearance of the pavilion at Grant Park on a hot July Saturday. The benches are spread with boxes and sacks, sandwiches, chicken, cake, all the other essentials of a picnic lunch save ice-cold lemonade, are passed about from man to man, and the noon hour dinner is eaten with as much good-natured laughter as if there was never such a thing in the world as a murder trial. True, most of the table conversation is of the latest testimony, and if there are after-dinner speeches made, they are sure to take a theoretic turn. But the afternoon session is an aid rather than a hindrance to digestion. There are even some people who do not eat. They had rather go hungry than leave the courtroom and lose a coveted seat. As a result, there is not much chance for any spectator who comes to the trial in the afternoon with the hope of getting in. The benches are never deserted, and those who come at 7 o'clock in the morning are sure to stick until 5 in the afternoon. Thursday at noon, relief came to the hungry ones. A small red-headed boy slipped by the guard with a big basket on his arm. He had hardly gotten inside the courtroom and opened his mouth to shout, "Sandwiches!" before the spectators fell upon him. In 5 minutes, he was stripped of his load. What matter if he charged 4 bits apiece for pieces of mince pie? There was not a purchaser who kicked. It was worth half a dollar to retain one's seat and be well fed at the same time. Page 4, column 1. Watchman swears. Elevator was open. Changes evidence. E.F. Holloway angers. Dorsey, when he testifies, contrary to affidavit, had told Dorsey, elevator switch was locked. Court adjourned at 4:58 o'clock until 9 o'clock Friday morning, after a day of surprises in the trial of Leo M. Frank, charged with the murder of Mary Fagan in the National Pencil Factory building. That the switchboard which controls the motor used to operate the elevator in the National Pencil Factory, where Mary Fagan was murdered, was left unlocked Saturday morning when he left the building at 11:45 o'clock, and that anybody could have entered and run the elevator up and down the shaft during the balance of the day, was the statement of E.F. Holloway, one of the factory's watchmen at the trial of Leo M. Frank, late Thursday afternoon. Although Holloway made an affidavit for solicitor Hugh M. Dorsey, which he identified in the courtroom, swearing to the fact that he left the switch box locked on that Saturday, he positively declared on Thursday that he left it unlocked, and when confronted with his own signature answered, "I forgot." When Holloway took the stand, he had hardly started his narrative when Solicitor Dorsey cut him short and addressed the court. "I wish to state that I have been entrapped by this witness." The solicitor's remarks followed the statement of Holloway that he unlocked the switchbox to operate the motor to cut some boards and ran the elevator up to the third floor for White and Denham, and left the box unlocked. Dr. Claude Smith, city bacteriologist, was on the stand for a while and testified that stains upon certain chips which were brought to him by city detectives, presumably cut from the second floor of the pencil factory, contained blood corpuscles. He could not say, however, that it was human blood. He only knew that it was the blood of a mammal, and under cross-examination by attorney Rosser admitted that it might have been the blood of a mouse. Dr. Smith examined the shirt, said to have been found in the house of Newt Lee, and declared that the shirt was not soiled save for blood stains and that it appeared not to have been worn recently, as there were no body odors on it. Mary Fagan had been dead 10 or 15 hours when her body was examined by William A. Giesling of P.J. Bloomfield's Undertaking Establishment. Shortly after 4 o'clock on the Sunday morning, her body was discovered in the basement of the pencil factory. According to Giesling's testimony given at the trial of Leo M. Frank during Thursday afternoon session. Thus, according to the undertaker, the little girl met her death sometime between the time that she entered the factory at 12:10 o'clock Saturday afternoon and 6 o'clock of the same day. Not later than 6 o'clock. Mrs. Applebaum present. Mrs. Callie Scott. Applebaum, whose trial and acquittal upon the charge that she murdered her husband in an Atlanta hotel was a recent sensation in Atlanta, became one of the women spectators in the courtroom shortly after the afternoon session convened. Under cross-examination by attorney Arnold, Stafford testified that on Friday preceding the murder, he had swept the floor of the entire metal room. The job took him about 3 hours, he said. He worked from 9 o'clock until 12. He swept beneath all of the machines and even removing boxes and barrels and other debris stored next to the women's toilet. He swept under Mary Fagan's machine and under the lathe used by Barrett. "The area that he swept is as big as the courtroom," he said. "Was it your duty to sweep this room?" asked attorney Arnold. "It was my duty to sweep part of it, where the concrete floor is." "That," he said, "is little less than half of the total area." "Why did you go on and sweep the wood floor when you were supposed to sweep only the concrete floor? Did you just start to sweeping and then couldn't stop?" "No, sometimes I sweep the whole floor." "Who told you to sweep this part?" "Nobody." "A Negro was paid to sweep this, wasn't he?" "Yes." "Wasn't it a Negro's duty to sweep that same place that same day?" "No, the Negro usually swept it on Saturday." "Were you paid by the hour or by the piece?" "By the hour." "In sweeping this floor," said Stanford, "he saw a few paint spots near the entrance of the women's dressing room and also near the door of the room where lacquer is kept." "Will you swear that there were not half a dozen other spots in that room, of one kind or another?" "Yes." Mrs. George W. Jefferson was called to the stand. She is an employee of the National Pencil Factory. She was in the factory on April 25th and again on April 28th. She passed through the metal room on the 25th to the polishing room and didn't notice any blood spots, but did see spots on the floor there Monday. She described the blood spots. She works in the polishing room on the same floor with the metal room. In the polishing room, about 50 feet from the blood spotty, on a post a number of pieces of twine cord usually hang. "The color of the blood spots was dark," she said, "but there was some whitish stuff spread over them." Picking up a cord, Solicitor Dorsey asked the witness if she had seen any cord like that in the factory. "Yes," she said. "It was similar to lengths of cord that hung on the post." "How long have you been working in the polishing room?" "About 5 years." "Are any paints kept in the polishing room?" "Yes." "Any red paints?" "Yes." "How many different shades of red paint are kept there?" 3 maroon red, red line, and bright red." "Are you familiar with these paints?" "Yes, I should be. I use them enough in polishing." "Those are all the paints there?" "Yes." "Spot was not paint." "Could you distinguish one of these paints from another?" "Yes." "Could you tell whether or not the red spot had been made by one of the paints used in the polishing room?" "It was not one of the paints." Attorney Rosser took up the cross-examination.
How did you happen to discover those dark spots near the dressing room door? He asked.
Mr. Barrett and I discovered them together at about the same time.
Did you discover them, or did Barrett call your attention to them?
I had been over to Mary Fagan's machine and was on my way back to the polishing room where I worked when we saw the spot. I think Mr. Barrett saw it first.
Barrett was going around looking for spots, huh?
He made a search of the metal room. The floor in the metal room is dirty and greasy, is it not?
Yes.
There are a good many dark spots on it?
I've seen greasy spots, but no spots like the one by the dressing room door.
Where were the paints kept?
In the polishing room.
Were there no paints in the metal room?
No.
After the coloring matter is mixed with the grease, it is difficult to tell the color, is it not?
I never tried that.
Did the white stuff hide the red spot?
No.
How many other red spots did you find around the metal room?
I didn't find any others.
You say you knew Mary Fagan?
Yes, for about a year.
Spot chipped up later. How much of that white stuff was there?
It covered a place about as big as my fan. The witness exhibited a palm leaf fan of ordinary size.
This spot later was chipped up, was it not?
Yes.
Come down, said Mr. Rosser.
Solicitor Dorsey told her to wait.
Where are the pencils painted?
Inquired the solicitor.
On the third floor.
Where else are the paints used?
Nowhere, except on the third floor and in the polishing room on the second floor.
After the paints are carried into the polishing room, is there ever any occasion to take them out to the metal room?
No, sir.
Mr. Dorsey sat down as if he had finished with the witness, and Mr. Rosser arose again.
Mrs. Jefferson, these cords are scattered around all over the building, are they not? Inquired Mr. Rosser.
No, sir, they are not supposed to be.
Well, where are they kept?
On the post in the polishing room.
Do you mean to say that there are none of these cords anywhere else about the building?
Cords in polishing room.
As a matter of fact, don't they sometimes fall on the floor, and aren't they sometimes carried in the sweepings to the basement?
I have never been to the basement, have you?
No, sir.
You don't know whether there are any cords down there or not?
No, sir.
As a matter of fact, Mrs. Jefferson, haven't you within the past 3 months seen cords like this on the first floor of the factory?
No, sir, I have not.
Well, where else have you seen them beside the polishing room and the third floor?
Nowhere else.
Mr. Rosser sat down, and Mr. Dorsey questioned the witness.
Do they have any need for cords in the basement?
None that I know of.
Hazlitt on stand. City Detective B.B. Hazlitt was called to the stand. He told of going to Frank's house Monday morning at 7 o'clock to get him to go to the police station. Answering questions put by Solicitor Dorsey, he said that Frank was not arrested at this time and was kept at detective headquarters only 2 or 3 hours. Said that they told Frank at his house that Chief Lanford wanted to see him. Frank appeared willing to accompany them and said,
"Wait a minute and I'll be with you."
Do you know when Frank was arrested?
No, sir, I do not.
Whom did you see at detective headquarters that morning?
I saw Mr. Rosser and Mr. Haas after I had gone up the street and come back.
Attorney Rosser cross-examined him.
What time did you say you saw Mr. Haas and me there?
Asked Mr. Rosser.
I think it was about 8 o'clock, as nearly as I can recollect. I won't swear to the exact time.
Mr. Rosser asked for details about the detective's actions at Frank's house, in an apparent effort to gain from Detective Hazlitt an admission that Frank was detained against his will.
You know, don't you, that Frank didn't get away from detective headquarters until nearly 12, don't you?
No, I didn't stay there until 12.
As a matter of fact, when you went out to Frank's house, it wasn't a question of whether or not he wanted to go, was it?
I don't suppose it was.
Why did they send two of you?
Well, we generally work two together.
Well, now, if Frank had resisted Mr. Hazlitt, wouldn't you have brought him anyhow?
Yes, I guess we would.
Undertaker testifies. William A. Giesling was called to the stand. He is an undertaker employed by P.J. Bloomfield. Giesling said that he went to the pencil factory at about 10 minutes to 4 o'clock on the morning that the body was discovered and found the body lying face down on the ground on the spot where it was discovered. The cord and the loop of an undergarment strip still were around the neck, said he.
He put the remains in a basket and carried them to the undertaking establishment, said he. The impression that the loop and the cord had left on the neck of the body was an eighth of an inch deep, said he. What was the state of the body as regards rigor mortis? Asked the solicitor. Dead, 10. Or 15 hours. The body was rigid, said the witness. How long would you estimate that she had been dead?
10 or 15 hours and maybe more, answered Gisling.
He said that the blood on her clothes had coagulated. Blood had settled in her face, her head being lower than the rest of the body. The solicitor asked him how long it takes usually for blood to settle.
Sometimes it settles in a few minutes, said the witness.
Did you examine her nails?
After Dr. Hurt.
What did you discover under her fingernails?
Only dust.
Did you observe anything about her eyes?
There was a bruise over the right eye, said the witness. Evidently it had been made before death, for it had swelled.
Were there any other wounds? Asked the solicitor.
There were two on the back of the head.
Describes wounds. If you made an examination, tell the jury about it.
The skull was not fractured, said the witness, but the scalp was broken.
Were there any marks on the body that could have been made by dragging?
There was a scar over each eye about the size of a dime.
What was the condition of her nose?
I don't know.
Were you present when Frank came to the undertaking place on the morning of Sunday, April 27th?
Yes. I didn't know who Frank was until afterward, though.
Did you observe his conduct particularly?
No.
Can you say whether or not he looked upon the body?
I cannot.
Can you say what caused the death of Mary Fagan?
Before the witness could reply, Attorney Rosser objected on the ground that the witness was not competent, not being a physician. Judge Roan held that the solicitor would have to qualify the witness as an expert. The solicitor withdrew his question with the comment that he would prove that by somebody else. Rosser takes witness. The witness was cross-examined by Mr. Rosser.
Was the blood under her hair damp?
I don't know.
Well, if it had been damp an hour before you found the body, how long would you say that she had been dead?
Between 10 and 15 hours, I would say.
I don't go by the blood at all, but by the status of the rigor mortis. Attorney Rosser brought out from the witness the statement that rigor mortis sets in more quickly in certain cases than in others. The witness admitted that he had little experience with strangulation cases. He had embalmed the bodies of a couple of men who were hanged. They were the only cases that he remembered. The witness discussed the action of blood after death and said that no blood would come from a wound after the last heart action unless the body was moved or it was forced out by some pressure. Attorney Rosser brought out that in embalming the body, Gisling removed half a gallon of blood and put in a gallon of embalming fluid. The witness was asked the formula of the embalming fluid that he used and asked the court that he be not made to answer as the formula is one of his own, which it has taken him 15 years to perfect. The attorney withdrew the question. Body not mutilated. The most interesting fact brought out by the cross-examination of Gisling was that Mary Fagan's body was in no way mutilated. Attorney Rosser brought out that Dr. Hurt had probed under the girl's fingernails, but the witness did not know what he had found. The witness stated that Dr. Hurt made a post-mortem examination of the body on Monday. The witness convulsed the court when, in reply to Rosser's questions as to whether the girl's underclothes had been torn or cut, he replied he was no dressmaker and couldn't tell. Solicitor Dorsey asked the witness a final question. Had the girl lost much blood when you examined the body?
She couldn't have lost much, was the answer.
Dr. Claude Smith was called as the next witness. He is a physician and is the Atlanta City bacteriologist and chemist. Found blood on chips. Solicitor Dorsey handed to the witness some chips. Dr. Smith, have you made any tests on these chips? If so, when?
These chips appear to be specimens that the detectives brought to me at my office.
What was their condition?
They were very dirty and there appeared to be a stain upon them. I examined several specimens and on one specimen I found blood corpuscles.
The chips were the ones exhibited previously as having been dug from the metal room floor.
Could you tell whether it was human blood or not?
I could not.
The shirt that the detectives claimed to have found in the barrel at Newtley's house was handed to the witness. He was asked if he had seen it before. The shirt was one that the detectives had brought to him, said the witness.
He started to repeat something that the detectives told him when they delivered the shirt. Mr. Rosser objected.
We don't care anything about that. We want to hear what you know of your own knowledge.
Shirt never worn. Solicitor Dorsey added,
Yes, just tell us what you found.
The witness stated that he examined the stains on the shirt. They reacted under the chemical test and also under the microscope. The witness examined the armpits of the shirt, and it was his opinion that it hadn't been worn. Mr. Rosser objected.
We don't want your opinion on commonplace subjects, said he.
Dr. Smith continued that blood had been smeared over the inside of the shirt, and very little of it had penetrated outside. It was wadded together in some places as if it had been used to wipe something. Again, Mr. Rosser objected, declaring that the witness merely was giving his own conclusion, that he was supposed to give the condition of the shirt without surmise. Judge Roan advised the witness to state just what condition the shirt was in when it reached him. Solicitor Dorsey declared that the shirt had been produced by Mr. Rosser for the defense, and that he wanted the witness to tell the jury what its condition was when the detectives gave it to him. Mr. Rosser rejoined, I was just showing what John Black had been doing that he had been finding a shirt.
Go ahead, doctor, and tell us about the condition of the shirt, said Mr. Dorsey.
It was not soiled around the inside of the collar, said the witness. It had every appearance of having been washed, but not worn. He said there was no odor to it. Manifesting some impatience, Mr. Rosser jumped to his feet and asked that the witness's reply be stricken from the record. He declared that the witness was not discussing a scientific matter, but a commonplace one, which did not require expert testimony.
All this stuff about odors is not a medical question, asserted Mr. Rosser.
He ought to discuss only those things which the jury cannot determine for themselves. Solicitor Dorsey asked the witness to tell the condition of the shirt and omit his conclusions. There was no odor to the shirt. There was no evidence of soiling on the inside of the collar. Most of the blood was on the inside of the shirt. Rosser's examination. Mr. Rosser Cross examined the witness. He endeavored to make the witness admit that under some circumstances, such as the tail of the shirt being turned up, it could be soiled outwardly, yet appear to have been soiled from the inside. Dr. Smith was inclined to dispute that theory. Again, growing impatient, Mr. Rosser declared that the witness had been arguing ever since he came on the stand.
You say there was no stain on the inside of the collar?
There was none.
There was a pungent odor of blood, wasn't there?
Yes, there was some odor from the blood.
Then the blood odor might destroy the body odor, might it not?
Somewhat.
You say the odor of the shirt was that of a garment that had been washed and was fresh?
If a person had just worn this shirt a short while, there wouldn't be much odor, would there?
Yes, there would be some odor.
If he had put it right on and taken it right off, you still could detect it? Mr. Rosser counted out 4 chips in the package and handed them to the witness. Dr. Smith admitted that he could not tell on which one of the 4 chips he found the blood. Dr. Smith continued that blood corpuscles could remain on the floor or piece of wood for years if they were not disturbed in any way. He said, however, that they dissolved rapidly when water was put with them. He had not examined the blood on the chips for quantity, said the witness, but admitted that all of the corpuscles that he saw, some 4 or 5, could have been left there from 1 drop of blood. He could only tell that it was the blood of a mammal.
Blood of a mouse?
He admitted that the blood might have been from a mouse, but refused to state that it was not the blood of an animal. Some experts could tell the difference between human and brute blood, but he could not. Dr. Smith was asked a number of questions relative to rigor mortis, which, said he, usually starts very soon after death. It was complete in a number of instances in about 10 hours, he said. Mr. Rosser attempted repeatedly to make the witness say that a person taking off the shirt could have folded it so that the different blood spots would have been distributed upon it as they appeared in court, but the witness contended that it was hardly possible. Some of the blood on the inside of the shirt was only 6 inches from the armpits, he said. E.F. Holloway, watchman at the National Pencil Factory, was called to the stand. In reply to questions by Solicitor Dorsey, he said that he worked in the pencil factory on the Saturday of the murder, from 6:20 a.m. until 11:45, and that among his duties was the supervision of the elevator.
What do you do when you leave usually? Asked the solicitor.
What did you do regarding the elevator when you left on Saturday?
I had cut two planks for white and denim, and I started the elevator to the third floor, where they were working. Solicitor Dorsey addressed the court. I want to say right now that I have been entrapped by this witness straight out. The solicitor addressed this question to the witness after taking some affidavits and papers from his table. On May 12, 1913, in the presence of E.S. Smith, stenographer, Detective Starnes and Campbell, and myself, didn't you say regarding the power box that enables you to run the elevator that you kept it locked all the time? I said I left it locked Friday night. Where did you leave the elevator Friday night? I left it on the second floor. Was it there when you left the building that Friday night? Yes. On Saturday. Where was the elevator when you left? Switchbox unlocked. I did some sawing for Mr. White and Mr. Denham and sent it up and left the switchbox unlocked Saturday. Didn't you say you never heard of the insurance company ordering the switchbox kept open all the time? One day in my office? And don't you know that you said Mr. Darley had instructed you to keep it locked all the time? And isn't it a fact that the box was locked Saturday morning at 11:45 when you left the building? It was not. Why then? Did you tell me it was? I forgot. What was it Frank said to Newt Lee Friday night? You heard what he said, didn't you? I didn't hear him say anything to Newt Lee. Solicitor Dorsey picked up an affidavit. You signed your name to this paper, didn't you? The witness replied, yes. Why did you say the box was always kept locked? I forgot. Holloway proceeded to testify that he saw Frank leave the pencil factory at 9:45 a.m., Saturday, April 26th, to go to Montag Brothers. Did you ever see Gant speak to Mary Fagan while he was working in the factory? No. The witness had misunderstood the question, he said, asking that it be repeated. The lawyers for the defense interposed that he was hard of hearing. Mr. Dorsey repeated the question. I saw him talking to her frequently. And where? Around the time clock, where I would stop to register. What is the condition of the stairs that lead from the ground floor to the back of the basement? It is good, answered the witness. Are these stairs nailed up? If so, how long have they been nailed up? All this year. Were you there Monday morning after the murder? I was. What do you know about the insurance people going through the building? I saw a crowd of men in the basement. Do you know when that area down there was cleaned up? About 2 weeks after the murder. That closed the direct examination, and the witness was turned over to Attorney Arnold. Mr. Holloway, all Saturday morning the front doors were unlocked, were they not? Began Mr. Arnold. Yes. When those men, Denham and White, wanted you to saw those boards for them, you had to use the motor, didn't you? Yes. That's the same motor that runs the elevator, isn't it? Yes. And you left the switch box open when you left, did you? Yes. Elevator open. Then anybody could run the elevator after that? Anybody, yes. Mr. Holloway, isn't the floor of the metal department dirty and greasy? There's not a worse one in town. During the 3 years he has worked in the pencil factory, said the witness, the floor of the metal room has not been scoured once. Mr. Holloway, spots are not uncommon on this floor, are they? No, sir. Have you ever seen spots that looked like blood around the ladies' toilet? Yes. Did you ever see the spots that Barrett claims to have discovered on the floor of the metal room? I saw it late on Monday. This man Barrett discovered mighty near everything that was found in the building, didn't he? So he claims, said the watchman. Did you ever see Frank speak to Mary Fagan? Did you see Newt Lee when he got there Monday? Yes, he was just going out with the detectives. Who came next? Either White or Denham. I don't know which. He went upstairs. Who was the next to come in? Alonzo Mann, the office boy. Who next? Mr. Frank, I think. What did he do? He opened the safe, got out the books, and went to work. Who came next? Maddie Smith. She worked there. Who came next? I don't remember. Didn't you see Corinthia Hall, another young woman, come in? No, I met them at Hunter and Broad Streets after I left the factory. Miss Emma asked if there was anybody at the factory. She was getting cold and wanted to get a wrap, she said. I told her Mr. Frank was there and would let her in. Who else came in the factory while you were there?
Graham and others came in while I was upstairs with White and Denim.
Are there double doors leading back to the metal room? Are they kept locked?
Yes, but they're not kept locked. One stays closed and the other open.
They couldn't be locked.
There's no lock on them. The doors are there to keep the steam out of the packing department. One is kept closed all the time when the factory is working.
On the Friday before the murder, did you turn the building over to Newt Lee?
Yes.
Who closed up the building?
Lee.
He closes all doors and windows?
Yes.
On all the floors?
Yes.
It's his duty to go to the basement and the back door of the basement?
Yes.
What other Negroes are employed in the factory?
Nolis, the fireman, Jim Conley, the sweeper, Bill McKinley, Fred Howell, who sweeps the metal room, and Joe Williams.
Have you ever heard of Stanford sweeping up the cement floors and the wood floors around the metal room?
Yes, frequently.
He's done that all this year when we've been short of hands.
The factory usually paid off on Saturdays at 12 o'clock?
Yes.
Where were the employees paid off?
Near the clock.
Frank didn't usually pay off, did he?
No, sir.
When were the employees paid off on the Friday before the murder? What time?
About 5:45 or 6 o'clock.
Saturday was a holiday?
Yes.
You put up signs notifying the employees that they would be paid off on Friday night?
Yes, sir. I put signs up on every floor.
What time did you usually get to the factory in the mornings to relieve the night watchman?
Always at 6:20 o'clock.
Did you ever come to the factory on Sundays?
No, sir.
Who was there on Sundays?
Nobody.
How was the elevator entrance closed?
By sliding doors.
Could anybody raise them?
Yes.
What is the condition on the first floor?
Very dark. There are always a lot of boxes piled around.
Anybody coming in from the light of the street would find it hard to see.
Could anybody raise the doors and get into the elevator shaft from the first floor?
Yes.
These doors slide up and down on weights, like windows.
Were the same kind of doors on the elevator on the second floor?
Yes.
Did you see Mrs. White before you left the factory that Saturday morning?
No, sir. She came after I left.
You say there are two time clocks, one registering from 1 to 100 and the other from 101 to 200?
Yes.
There are about 160 employees in the factory. Everyone has a number. That makes it necessary to have two clocks. Newt Lee, the night watchman, was expected to punch every half hour to show he was there 24 times every 12 hours?
Yes.
Was the shipping clerk at the factory that Saturday morning?
Yes.
He was there about 2 hours. He came at 8 o'clock and stayed until 10 o'clock.
Where is the shipping department?
Just off from the packing department on the second floor.
When Maddie Smith was paid off, she found a mistake had been made in her pay, did she not?
Yes.
She found it out just about the time she came out of the office and her pay, did she not?
Got as far as the clock. Darley accompanied her back into Mr. Frank's office and corrected the mistake. The stenographer, Miss Hattie Hall, came in during the morning, did she not?
Yes. I saw her at the typewriter in the outer office.
What time did Frank come back from Montag Brothers?
About 11 o'clock.
Did he have a paper in his hand or a folder?
Yes.
He always carried this folder over to Montag Brothers and brought it back with him.
When Frank returned from Montag Brothers, did he go right up to office?
Continued Mr. Arnold.
Yes.
The stenographer was still in the outer office?
Yes.
We have some cords here. Mr. Arnold picked up a piece of cord. You used these cords in various parts of the factory building, did you not?
Yes, everywhere in the building.
You can find them in various parts of the building?
Everywhere.
They come to the factory tied around bundles of slats, do they not?
And pencils are made out of these slats?
Yes.
These cords are hung about on nails and get into the trash every day, do they not?
Yes.
It's impossible to keep them from being scattered around.
Did you see Mae Barrett that Saturday morning?
Yes. I met her going up into the building.
Did you see Mary Fagan?
No, sir.
Did you see Mary Fagan's body?
Yes.
Did you recognize it?
Yes.
You knew her by name?
Yes.
She was stout and stockily built?
Yes.
Was the Negro Conley familiar with the metal room?
Yes, he was familiar with every part of TE building.
On redirect examination, Solicitor Dorsey asked Holloway this question. In my office, did you not tell me that you locked the power box of the elevator on Saturday?
I don't remember.
Solicitor Dorsey took up a stenographic record and read this extract. Do you generally keep the power box locked? Answer,
yes.
Where do you keep the key?
Answer,
in the office. Did you lock the box on Saturday?
Answer, yes.
Did you read over this record before you signed it? Demanded the solicitor.
Yes, said the watchman.
I read it over, but I didn't tell you anything about sawing wood on that Saturday. And I remembered that I left the box unlocked and put the key in the office where I got it Monday. The solicitor grilled the witness on previous statements by himself in contrast with those offered here in court. Attorney Arnold said to the witness, "You forgot to tell him about sawing the planks, and that reminded you about unlocking the elevator and then taking the key to the office, where it was because there is a spring lock on the power box?"
"That's right," the witness said.
After the witness left the stand, Solicitor Dorsey tendered in evidence that portion of the stenographic record of Holloway's statement to him, which referred to the power box, saying that the witness did not admit saying that he locked the box on Saturday. The attorneys for the defense contended that he did admit saying that he had locked the box, although he was mistaken about it. The witness was called back to the stand, and then he clearly admitted that he had said to the solicitor that he had told him that he locked the box on Saturday. Solicitor Dorsey then declared that he still wanted to put the stenographic record in record as it was the highest and best evidence of the witness's contradictory statement by which he, Dorsey, had been entrapped. To avoid a tedious argument, said the solicitor, he would waive the point inasmuch as he had secured the witness's admission that he had contradicted himself. Solicitor Dorsey called for Mrs. Arthur White as the next witness, but Judge Roan declared it was time to adjourn. Before adjourning, however, the court asked if any of the jurors had any complaint to make of treatment they were receiving. Juror Winburn said they had had a complaint relative to their rooms, but he understood the matter would be rectified by the sheriff. Page 6, Column 2, Mrs. Callie Scott, Applebaum, attends trial of Leo Frank, believes in his innocence, Mrs. Callie Scott, Applebaum. A woman sat among the spectators at the Frank trial Thursday afternoon, a pretty blue-eyed woman neatly clad in a white shirtwaist and black skirt. 4 months ago, she was thinking, I was in the position of that boyish-limbed youth over there. 4 months ago, I, too, was accused of murder, was on trial for my life. 4 months ago, men and women came to stare at me, even as I am staring at him now. The woman was Mrs. Callie Scott Applebaum, who was freed last spring of the charge of slaying her husband in the Dakota Hotel. This is the second time in my life, she said Thursday afternoon, that I have been in a courtroom. The first time was when I myself was on trial, so of course I know just how it feels. Believe me, I can sympathize with Mr. Frank, and I do. Mrs. Applebaum says she has been living in Atlanta for several months, working at a beauty parlor. And that Thursday was the first time she was able to get somebody else to take her place so she could come to the trial. I believe in his innocence, for a man like that could never do the thing he is accused of. All through the afternoon, Mrs. Applebaum sat in the courtroom, her intent expression showing that she was greatly interested in every phase of the testimony. Yes, she said, as court adjourned for the afternoon. I am coming again just as soon as I can. You see, it is much better to be a spectator than a prisoner.